Which doors, just as if it seems to know, I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
You don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the skies.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Yeah, Riders on Riding, every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes. If you go to, Radio Public, go scan down to KUCI, click, you will be able to listen easily. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. The show, as always, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And I'm happy to be back today. I have a bit of a cold, so I hope I don't sound too much like a stuffed frog. And I'll try to deal with that. Have my water here. I think it'll be fine. We have a wonderful show. We have two wonderful writers, Robert McLarty and Darren Strauss. Robert is a native of East Providence, Rhode Island. He's a veteran actor, accomplished playwright, and prolific audiobook narrator. He's the author of two previous novels, The Memory of Running, which was on the New York Times hardcover extended fiction bestseller list, and Traveler, which has just been published by Penguin in paperback. He's been on TV. He's a character actor, a regular on the new Fox series, The Return of Jezebel James, playing Parker Posey and Lauren Ambrose's father. McLarty has written dozens of plays, which have been produced across the country. He received an honorary doctorate of humanities from Rhode Island College in 2007 and the Charles B. Willard Achievement Award in 2005. He's been living in New York with his wife, and he's here to discuss his new book, Art in America. Darren Strauss will be blogging about his tour for Newsweek.com. He is the author of the international bestseller Chang and Eng and the New York Times notable book, The Real McCoy, one of the New York Public Library's 25 Books to Remember of 2002. His work has been translated into 14 languages, and he teaches writing at New York University, for which he won a 2005 Outstanding Dozen Teaching Award. Darren is also a screenwriter, and he sold the rights to Chang and Eng to Disney and is currently adapting the novel for the screen with the actor Gary Oldman. Darren was awarded a 2006 Guggenheim in fiction writing. He lives in Brooklyn, and he's here to discuss his new novel, More Than It Hurts You. Hi, you two.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me on, or both of us on.
I'm so glad you're both there. Sometimes it's questionable whether I'll find anyone on the other end once I go through all that, so I'm glad it worked out.
Well, isn't that the way life always is, though?
You know, I'm just really glad. I wanted to have both of you on since I became aware of your new books. I just, while your books are really different, somehow there are certain similarities that seem to run through, I don't know, your writing lives, maybe even through your novels. These books are both your third published books, and while your novel, Darren, is more, oh, I don't know, dramatic, and your book, Ron, is more on the lighthearted side, somehow they cross over. They're multiple plotted books, and they just have so much going on. I wonder if both of you would talk about the genesis of your novels. Do you want to go first, Darren?
Sure. Well, my book is about a lot of things, but it's in large part about Munchausen by proxy, which is a condition whereby mothers or parents, but usually the mothers, are accused of hurting their child to get attention. And it really only happens in America and the UK. And so I thought that was a very interesting subject to write a book about, not only because it could be very suspenseful, a child in danger, but also it says so much about this country, you know, that some of us will go to any length to get attention, including poisoning their own kid or hurting their own kid. And so I wanted the book to tackle that, and also race, because I made the doctor black and the family white. And so I was kind of inspired by the Updike Rabbit books, where he, you know, in, say, Rabbit Redux, he uses the moon landing as a news hook, but then uses that story to sort of examine the state of America at the time. And so that's what I wanted to do. The book, it's interesting. It involves race scandals and gender and healthcare. So I've been lucky that that's kind of the big topic of this election season. I didn't know that was going to be the case when I started writing it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting how that works. What about you, Ron?
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was saying, Ron. What about your book?
Well, my first. This is, you know, I have kind of a funny story to tell about my. I wrote 10 novels that I couldn't get published. over 35 years, and in many ways it helped me be an actor, because I never got my feelings hurt as an actor. My feelings were always hurt as a writer because I couldn't get them published. And the book that got me out there and was Memory of Running, and that's because I taped it. I've done over 100 audiobooks, and I put it directly onto audio for a small company. They published it before it was published in paper, and then Stephen King listened to it and wrote an article about me, and the next thing I knew, I was published. But the first two books that Penguin Viking did were sort of serious trips and very introspective and told in the first person. And while I liked them very much, I wanted to tell something that could give people more of a humorous ride, I think. Still making it about something, but putting a lot of humor in it. And that's how I came up with Art in America. I wanted to write contrasting the art scene of the West with the New York art scene, and the characters that I've known and loved from the time I've spent out in the West, and I think I did it, and I think especially the fact that I wanted it to be funny and I wanted it to be about a bedraggled, unpublished writer makes it a little autobiography of myself and. No, I'm satisfied with it. I don't know if a writer can say anything more about his own work than that.
So it sounds like for both of you with these books, theme came first. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
It sounds like for both of you, theme came first.
Well, I know for me, story always comes first. It wasn't a theme. I just had heard a story about a doctor who had been accused a doctor who went after a family because he knew the child was being poisoned, so he worked to get the child out of that dangerous environment, and the family went to the press and vilified the doctor, and he couldn't respond because he was bound by patient-doctor privilege, and so he looked anti-family and very zealous in the media, and so he had his reputation ruined, and the family got to keep the child, and so I just thought that was a good story. I'm always sort of on the hunt for good stories, and I think it's just kind of I'm sure you agree with this as well. It makes it easier to make an interesting book if you have an interesting story, which seems kind of self-evident, but I think a lot of books don't heed that lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a fun story. I mean, like with my first book was Chang Nang about conjoined twins, and I had been in graduate school at NYU taking writing classes, and everyone was writing kind of boringly autobiographical fiction, and I thought, well, my life's not that interesting, so I'll cast about for a good story. And, you know, Chang and Ang, they were conjoined twins attached to the chest from Siam, were kidnapped by the king, escaped to America, had 21 kids, got caught up in the Civil War, and I just thought, well, that's a good story. It beats my life, so.
And is that the case for you too, Ron?
It does, yeah. I have stories germinating, but they're never sort of fixed stories, and they're never things that I discover. They usually just start from inside me, and I always start out by writing them as a play. And when the play is finished, I'll bring some of my friends over to my house, because if you offer free dinner, you can get the actors to do anything. But they'll read through it, and they throw out some ideas about the characters. And then if I think that the whole thing can be contained in a play, I'll just keep writing it as a play. But often, like with every novel that I've written, it seemed like it was too big for the theater. And so with the grounding of the play and the sort of the framework of the characters and the understanding of them, and I would follow the story into a novel form. But it's it's probably pretty much the same thing. It's very odd, I find, the whole process of writing. Some days I'll sit down and I think I know when I'm really done and I'm really working hard and I'm really great, and I can get 6 or 7 pages out, and then I go to look at it the next morning and I realize, geez, I completely pulled the wool over my own eyes because it's terrible, these 6 or 7 pages. So it's a strange process, the whole idea of writing. I think for me the most important part of it is to write every day and to not have time in between and not to wait for inspiration. Maybe I've got too much of the old actor in me, but sometimes the inspiration doesn't come unless I get myself in a position to force it.
Yeah.
And I totally agree. That's what Mailer said the difference was between a professional writer and an amateur writer, is that the amateur writer can afford to wait till inspiration strikes, but the professional writer has to sit at his desk every day and knock something out.
Oh, that's great. I never heard that. Oh, well, he was great anyway. He got it.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you said about the lunacy of the process. That sometimes it takes me, I'll write just a page in a day. I'll spend a whole day writing a page, and then I'll come back and the next day and strike out that whole page. It just seems like writing is kind of a form of insanity.
Yeah, it really is. And a lot of my friends by the time I finally got published, I was 55, and a lot of them now have, of course, ideas. They want to write a book. And I tell them, a book is a slow thing to write. And actors want to sit down and get that book done in 10 days. And I said, you can't do it. It's a long, slow, arduous process. I feel just beaten up at the end of the day if I'm really onto something. I think that's like my criteria for knowing that maybe I'm writing the way I want to write this particular day because I'm so exhausted at the end of it.
And I think also people don't realize it takes a slow patience. And often I'm struck with people who come up to me and say, I want to write a book. And I say, well, what have you read recently, or who do you like? And they'll say, well, I'm not a big reader.
Yeah.
To me, that's like saying I want to be a baseball player, but I don't want to have to, practice shortstop or watch any ball games. I just want to jump into Yankee Stadium.
That's funny. The poet Billy Collins, he said that that what writers saying that, it's sort of like if you were to go to Juilliard and they say, well, who are your favorite musicians? And you say, well, I don't listen to music. I don't, that's not something I do.
Yeah.
They throw you out.
As long as we're quoting other writers, my favorite line about the writing process comes from Philip Roth, who said the difference between being a professional writer and being a pro athlete or a professional swimmer is that the gold medalist swimmer doesn't think she's going to drown every time she jumps into the pool.
That's a good one. It's a good one. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Ron McLarity, author of Art in America, and Darren Strauss, author of More Than It Hurts You. In talking about the writing process, this is pretty much a simplistic question, but it's one that I'm always asked by students and when I go to book events and various things. And I'm curious what you two will say, but in getting down that first draft, sitting there all day to get that page, are you working on the computer or are you doing it longhand?
I'm ashamed to admit, and Penguin Viking, my publishers, are also ashamed of me, but I do this longhand. I can't use a computer. And I send the first 100 pages that I've written longhand to a woman in California that I've bought a computer for. She can read my hand scratch. She types it up, emails it back to my wife. I correct it, mail it out to her, and she emails that's how I get my first draft done. It's caveman writing, I believe, as my editor Penguin says. But I think with my fingertips holding a pencil, I just don't think with I can type, but I don't think that way. I don't know how to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel comfortable with the just for example the email. My wife gets very angry at me. Because she says, look, I communicate with all of my friends this way. And I said, yeah, but you also get these personal notes sent to 300 other people.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It just I don't think we're ever going to have the collected emails.
There's been a book of... There's been a few email novels, which is kind of funny to me, where, novels composed of different emails.
Yeah.
But I'm the opposite. I mean, I guess I'm a creature of my generation, but I can't write longhand because I need to be able to move things around and take blocks of text and cut and paste them, and it just makes it so much easier for me. So I can't imagine having a different way of doing it where you actually have to write it longhand. And then, I mean, how do you then go about moving stuff around and revising stuff?
Well, I have all my different colored pencils with me, and when I get to a section I'm crossing out, I'll just completely cross it out, and I write insert new page, and then I'll write a new page out and stick it in there. I think it probably does make it longer, but there again, it's how how we think, you know.
Yeah.
I need to have that sensation of writing the way I used to do it when I was 9 years old. Plus, you know, when there's a downside to it, because when I finally did sell Memory of Running, this agent, the first agent I ever got, said, okay, now we're going to have an auction for the books, and what I want to do is get them on on a Thursday. On Monday, we'll get them on these publishers' desks along with the Stephen King article. I said, that's great, but half of my novel is still in longhand. He said, no, you're not telling me that. I said, yeah, so this is how I found the woman who could read my book. I went and I made about 5 calls to friends of mine, and everyone I called, they all said, you know, no, we don't know anybody that could do it that fast. And finally, I got a hold of this girl, and she said, yeah, but I can work nonstop, and I can kill myself over the weekend, but you're going to pay me for it. I said, all right.
She spent the whole half a novel in a weekend?
Yeah.
God, that's amazing.
Well, I think I won her name.
And she looked like she had been up with that half a novel the whole time, too. She was beat.
Oh, that's a great story. You know, this might be a great time to have you both read just a few minutes worth of your books before we continue our conversation. Who would like to go first?
Well, do you want? Shall I just read a little bit? Or?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, this is just a little thing that I picked out. It's actually the last 2 pages of the novel. The novel has already stopped, and this is months in advance of the end of the novel. My character had kind of had been on a search for he was a friendless guy. He was a writer who put all of his attention into just the words. He really got lost. He got out of the army with his 5,000-page manuscript, and it just all ballooned out of control till the point of here was this guy who just, you know, did a day laborer construction job while he was writing, and he had. Only one friend in the world, and he never ever had fallen in love, and now he's 48 years old. His whole world has gone topsy turvy on him, and for the better. And this is the very last 2 pages of the book. By early October, the aspen started gold, and the whole tone of the valley altered. Wildflowers had closed it up, and deer and elk and enormous transplanted moose got bolder, coming down to the big river in afternoon light. All in their own way anticipating the usually harsh late fall and winter. This Saturday morning came warmish, a sort of reprieve from high-altitude reality. They loaded the easel and paint box into her pickup and drove to the river, where it intersected the Norgan Ranch and where a decrepit railroad trestle crossed it. He pulled out his artist girlfriend's easel and started to set it up. She stood staring at the trestle. Not there. He waited. There. She took it over and set it up. You sure you're going to be all right? I should be about 3 hours. Usually Stephen Carney had Saturday and Sunday off from his job with South Fork Log Homes, but Buff Cryer, Dan's brother who owned and operated the business, had asked him for the favor, and he was happy for the work. A fellow from Colorado Springs wanted to get in as soon as possible, but the plumber was only available today or 2 weeks from the coming Monday. So Stephen was Buff's plumber's helper for the day. It took just under 4 hours to get it all up and flushing. Heading back to the trestle, he stopped for sandwiches and sodas at Ear Grove and put them in a small cooler. Where the valley started narrowing into the craggy groves, he saw that she had moved her easel to another spot, so that she looked down on the shattered old bridge. He pulled the truck off to the road shoulder and watched her for a few minutes. She stood with her charcoal frozen on the paper, looking hard for something. Finally, she pulled her hand off and walked away from the trestle, glancing over her shoulder as she moved. She stopped, made a mark on the ground with her foot, and went for the easel. He watched her move it, her strong arms, her sturdy steps. Then she was working the charcoal fast and sure across the slightly tilted paper. He felt as if he were hallucinating this new life, this new sense of things. She saw him and waved, and he started across the valley floor and the little gullies and rises that were part of it.
Thank you so much. That was Ron McLarity reading from Art in America, actually, the very ending of Art in America. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's going to be hard to follow. You're such a beautiful reader. I don't have an actor's training, so my voice is not so good. And actually, the part I'm going to read is on my website and was read. The excerpt is read on my website by Gary Oldman. So I'm going to now I'm doubly ashamed. It's going to be terrible. But
let's hear you.
this is from the middle of the book. It's about.
I think you sound great. I don't mean to interrupt you. You sound great.
Well, wait till I read it. But thank you. So this is from the middle of the book. It, as I said, it's about a family who has been accused of harming their child on purpose, and so the police come to take the kid away. And the character's name is Josh, the guy, and his wife has been accused, and her name is Dory. And he doesn't know if she's done it or not. He can't believe she would do something like that. And so that's the mystery that we don't know, at least for the first half of the book, whether or not she's guilty. And so it's in some part about how well can you know someone you're intimate with. But I'll just read a little bit from the middle.
Okay.
The question for Josh had always been, how much blindness does a happy life require? Josh had grown up watching the Mr. Magoo show, in which a wealthy man took on the difficulty of failed eyesight by sallying into the world as if everything were fine. He walked off the edge of a girder, the hard hats pointing, yelling, panicking. But right as he stepped into space, some crane swung an I-beam up under his shoes. Or he would saunter into an animal pen, mistaking it for a doctor's office, and caress a tiger in the belief that he was petting a kitten, and the jungle beast would purr and nuzzle. If Josh could just mosey through his days like Magoo through a room, narrowly avoiding the furniture of human faults, wasn't there a chance that the world might be flattered and agree with him and transform itself into a series of blessings? But if that worked, it led to another question, one he hadn't thought about before. What sort of life did that become? However, a greater sin than emotional blindness is to play at love without purpose, to be caught just visiting the high points of your own existence. Josh loved Dory honestly, faithfully, and blindly, and that was the reason he failed to avoid this strange shipwreck of his family life. The police had arrived at 7:30 a.m. on a Monday. Josh had had his dress shirt open, a tie flapping, unknotted, like a scarf. Coffee made Josh sweat through his shirt. His doorbell rang. The baby started to clap and laugh. Josh said, "Shh, cool it, buddy," which in hindsight felt the most excruciatingly mean thing he'd ever say to anyone. In the doorway stood a policeman with a mid-career softness at his middle. What can you do when a cop gets in your face with his arrogant nose? What can a father do when the police have legal authority to kidnap his son?
Thank you so much.
Oh, that is beautiful.
That was Darren Strauss reading from More Than It Hurts You. Great excerpts. We're going to take a real short break. When we come back, we'll have more of these two authors. Please stay with us.
Yeah, that really was great.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month, built in a day. let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM. KUCI in Irvine.
It's appalling. That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're also on the web at kuci.org. Also on iTunes. And we also have, 300 plus shows available on podcast. If you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. It will take you to the radio page that has a schedule, usually current, but not current right now, of guests and past guests and various things about the show. Also links to the podcast. This one should go up in the next week or so. And there's so many shows up from the last 10 years that we've been on the air. So give a listen. They're there all the time. They can be your own personal MFA program. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett still, and today I'm with Ron McLarity and Darren Strauss. And I've been worried this whole half hour that I pronounced your name wrong at the beginning, Ron. I hope I didn't say Robert McLarity, but if I did, I'm sorry. it's this head cold that makes me feel like I'm here, but not here. But anyway, we'll carry on. Anyway, let's get back to talking about your books. I loved hearing you both read. It's always interesting, I think, to hear writers read their own work with the intonation you intend and all that. I think all writers who can should read their own audiobooks, actually. But I know that's not always possible. But I wanted to talk about dialogue because you're both so good at it. And it seems to be one of those, more difficult things for new writers to write, to avoid the filler and to write dialogue that makes the reader lean in and want to hear more. Would you both talk about that and how you come at dialogue?
Sure, I'll go first, I guess, if you want. Dialogue is—it's funny. You think it would be easy because, the hard part of writing, I think, is crafting the lyrical sentences and the descriptions and the psychological insights. Whereas for me, dialogue is just being attentive to the way people talk. So sitting on the subway in New York City with a pen, I always sort of write down interesting phrases people have. But I think the mistake is, so you want it to be realistic sounding, but I think the mistake is to fill up pages with too much dialogue because dialogue should never really be there to be filler, but should reveal something about character or move the story along. And so that I think the key is to either make it reveal character, and if it moves the story along, to do it in a way that doesn't seem like the dialogue is exposition. I think that's where, because I teach at an MFA program, and I think that's where most students make their mistake, is that they want to get information across to the reader, so they'll have their characters say, "Hi, Bob, you know John," you know, in a way that people would never talk, but it's, they're not talking to each other, they're talking to the reader. So
yeah.
So you've got to, I think, avoid dialogue as exposition, and then it's just a case of having a good ear. I don't know what do you think about that?
Yeah, I was just going to say that my acting training, you know, they always have an actor keep a little spot in his brain to store the observations, not only the oddities of people, but the way they sound, their accents, the way they phrase things, the fact that they never speak in perfect sentences, and you just kind of store that back. And I find that I can recall a lot of these things, and it helps me with the dialogue. This real strange thing about being a writer, and I was so interested to see what you think about this, is that I was never able to put it into words, but I read a little biography of Wallace Stegner, and he was saying of all the arts, even painting, you know, when a painting is revealed, you can stand among them, and you can, the audience, and you can see whether it works or not. Same with a playwright, same with a, you know, a movie or even a television show, but a writer works in a sort of a void. You put it out there, and you're really almost not sure what works and what doesn't work. And you almost never really get true approbation because it's, you know, outside of a review, because, you know, your friends who love you are not going to say, you know, Ron, this really stinks. This is bad. So I suppose this is a segue into a question for you. Do you run into that, too? Do you ever wish there was more of an affirmative way to know if you're in the right direction or not?
Yeah, that's funny. My wife is a book reviewer, so she actually is a pretty harsh critic there. So that, I'm very lucky. I mean, she actually does sometimes say, Darren, this stinks. She actually, in my second book, she circled a chapter and drew a line through it and then drew a picture of a guy sleeping. So I got the point.
Oh, wow.
But even with reviews, because reviews, you know, reviews are so subjective, and I think the quality of book reviewing has really gone down in this country. I can even notice the difference between from my first book in 2000 and now. Even positive reviews, you know, are often off the mark or poorly written. One review will say this part's overwritten, and another part will say, "Oh, this part's too flatly written." And so, because it's so subjective, it's often very hard to get a sense.
Yeah.
I think you have to have a real aesthetic. At least I feel you have to have an aesthetic sort of philosophy in mind when you start, and just have faith in that. Because
yeah, you have to keep your own counsel. It really is true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. I also wonder sometimes if reviewers don't read other reviews and then sort of craft their reviews. But anyway, that's a whole other topic, I guess.
Well, I think that one interesting thing about writing is I think you have to have an odd temperament, because you have to be both really arrogant and really humble.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to be arrogant to think, hey, people are going to care what I write. And then also when you're on the page, you have to be arrogant because you want to strut your stuff. You want to go for it. You want to be as bold as possible.
Mm.
But then you also have to be incredibly humble in the second draft, because then you have to go back and look, as Ron was saying before, and say, wait, this actually, I pulled the wool over my own eyes, this is no good. And so I know a lot of people who are capable of writing pretty good first drafts, but it's those who can write really good second and third drafts, I think, that make it so that they can have that, they can go into it really swaggeringly and then can come back to it really sort of shyly and look and say, God, how bad is this? What did I screw up? And so, you know, be able to have both.
You know, I think it has to do with working with an editor too. That feeling, that the arrogance part of it, or being a little easier on yourself. If I was 35 when Stephen King wrote this article about me, 35, I would not have been able to work with an editor. I would have thought, right, hey, I must be great. That arrogance would have been wild. But at 55, you want to learn a little bit. You know, you want to. You're more open. At least in my case, I was much more open to even some of the things and the suggestions that hurt my feelings, especially when I realized they were right.
Well, you know, that leads me into the whole aspect of revision, and And I'd be curious, how does it go for you? I mean, do you both wait until you have an entire draft before you revisit your work? Do you let it cool for a while and then come back to it? Do you work on other things and then come back to it? And then once you're in it, in the revision, how is that? How does it go?
Well, I wanted to go back to something Ron had said earlier for a second, because I was 30 when my first book came out, and it was a bestseller, and so that was kind of odd, because, you know, I'd been totally broke, and no one read what I wrote, and then I had a best-selling first book, so it was at 30, so it was kind of tough. So, and my second book didn't do quite as well, and so that was, I think, I wouldn't think so at the time, but it was actually really good training for the third book to have to sort of buckle down and say, okay, what did I take for granted?
Yeah.
But what you're saying about the, I'm sorry, the other the question was,
in terms of revision, you know, like, how does it go? Do you get an entire draft down and then decide, you know, what stays, what goes? Do you show it to readers? Do you let it cool for a while before you revisit, or are you revising as you go along?
I don't know what Ron does, but I have a friend who, I mean, everyone's got their own process. I have a friend who writes everything on index cards before he starts writing, so he knows exactly what's going to happen and exactly how long the book's going to be. Before he even starts, he knows within 3 or 4 pages how long it's going to be, which to me would be incredibly stifling.
Well,
and then there are other people who go...
take the adventure away from writing the book.
What'd you say?
It would take that adventure of writing the book away.
Yeah, exactly. But then there are other people who just...
You know, when you sit down, you don't know what's
completely...
going to happen today.
Right. But then there are people who are completely in the dark and just write without any sense of where they're going. So I don't know about you, Ron, but what I do is I start without knowing where I'm going to go, and I write 100 pages, and I stop at that 100-page mark and say, okay, what do I have? And then I plot out the rest from there, and that's how I decide what goes, what stays. Mm. I want the book to be both well-plotted and spontaneous feeling, so that's how I do it. I don't know. What's your method?
Well, my main thing is, and I hope it works, and I'm never sure, is that I, because I write it first as a play, that I get into these characters that I want to take me on my journey, And if I love them enough, and if I capture them enough in the play, then they won't let me make a wrong turn for them. They might be difficult, and they might even be unlikable, but they'll behave the way they're supposed to behave, and they sort of set the guidelines for me in the stories as I get along. And you know, I am constantly rewriting. Like I say, I'll go back and read what I did the day before, and I'll cut, you know, 2 or 3 pages out of it, and go on, and then when I get a full manuscript, I'll have to set it aside, because I am a person who can easily fool himself. You know, I've come off stage after performances thinking, "Wow, have I nailed this Uncle Vanya?" And and my friends come backstage and say, "Are you all right? Is something wrong? You know, what's why did you do that?" So I just don't want it to happen in a book.
But that must be a great thing about acting, because you can gauge immediately with the audience response a little bit anyway. I mean, you know, you write a book, it takes a couple of years, and it takes a year for it to come out. So you have this sort of artistic constipation in a way, where you wait for so long for it to come out. Whereas, you know, you're on stage, you read the lines, and if you do well, you can sense the audience, and they applaud,
know,
and.
That's
and then you
true.
Move on to do the performance again the next day. That must be really satisfying.
The thing about me in the theater is that I take it so much less serious than my friends, because I always wanted to write. My feelings were always hurt because my books were never published. But my feelings were never hurt because I didn't get a role in the play, or I didn't get a movie that I wanted. And that feeling actually makes it easier to get roles, and, you know, not just as a side, because you don't bring angst or anxiety or disappointment. Now, I'm 61, and I still have my friends, you know, get teary over roles they haven't gotten, and I say, you know, it's time to stop that.
Yeah.
And so in that way, writing really saved me, because I got teary over my work not being accepted, and that sort of saved me as a writer. But I always had more of a mindset of the nose to the grindstone, and not needing that kind of instant response. I suppose as an actor, I've always been maybe a little embarrassed about it.
Hmm. Well, it's probably something more personal about a book too, because when you're an actor, you're reading someone else's lines. But when it's a book, you're bearing your own brain to the world.
Right. There's a big difference between being a creative artist and an interpretive artist. there's a huge difference. You're making your little spot in the world and not just being a member of a long chain of people who have done that same play over and over again.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Ron McClarity, author of Art in America, and Darren Strauss, author of More Than It Hurts You, and we have a few minutes left. You know, Ron, I wanted to ask you, how did you keep yourself going writing 10 unpublished books? I mean, what propelled you on? Because, you know, I have students who, you know, after one book that doesn't get published or that they've been working on for years, may become discouraged about, you know, feeling like this had to happen and you know, it's not happening. What's wrong?
You know, I will tell you that when I got out of the Army, I had a Stephen Carney-esque My Character's novel. I had a 3,000-page novel. I could say in two chapters what any other writer could say in a sentence. I didn't have any clue of what I was doing. When my mother and father, memory runs my third novel, and my mother and father had a terrible automobile accident, and they both died in it. And my father lived 10 days, my mother lived 6 weeks, and I wanted to write something about them, but instead I started to make notes for this play about this fat guy on a bicycle, which was the crux of the memory of running. And for the very first time after they passed away, I decided to tell myself a story. I realized I was always writing to try to get published. I was always writing to try to get all that love and respect from the publishing community, to make money, to do it. And for the very first time, I wrote this novel about this guy on this bicycle to appease myself without any thought of even sending it out, just day after day after day. And I found it a very healing kind of a thing. And from then on, I wrote every novel and everything I wrote that way, to please myself with it and to not let myself off the hook, you know, instead of trying to wow anybody. Whenever I went back to look at what I'd written the day before, I'd say, you know, that's a lie. That's just, it's not thought out. You're not moving it forward. And I know if I tell myself a good story, then I'm not going to shortchange anybody else. And that just got me to the point where I really stopped caring so much about getting published. My feelings, I wasn't feeling crushed. The work became more important than actually getting published. I know it might sound odd to some kid that, you know, has got his sights set on a bestseller, but when the work itself becomes more important than getting it published, then you're really on to something, because it just cleans your soul right out. I don't know how else to put it.
I think that's great advice for young writers, too, because I think so many young writers that I come across try to chase the market. They figure, well, historical fiction is hot right now, so I'll write a historical novel. But then by the time they finish the novel, the market has moved elsewhere. So you can't guess what the market's going to like. You have to write what you like, and then hopefully that's something you'll write passionately about because you like it, and then it'll be better.
Right, and there's certain kind of material that you as a human being can let move through you, and there's certain kind of material that you as a human being can say, well, I want to write about it, but it's not going to move through me. It's not going to infuse me and let all of myself get on that page.
It's very coincidental that I'm so very sorry to hear about your parents, and it's very coincidental because I actually was in a very bad car accident when I was in high school and someone died, and I'd never written about it because I just didn't know how to process it. But recently I wrote this nonfiction piece about it just for myself, and my publisher said, why don't you try to send it out? So actually, it's going to be on This American Life on Friday or Saturday, whenever they run This American Life. It's about my car accident. I just, for the first time, was able to write about it.
Oh, wow.
It's very funny. I've been able to talk about my mother and father's accident and in ways like this, you know, just sort of to brush over it and to... But my wife is always saying, why don't you write about it? And I said, well, I don't think I can right now. A few more years, I'll be able to.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was 20 years ago. It took me 20 years to be able to do it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, as you say, when you think more of the work than of publishing, you know, and the work is pushing you on, sometimes that is really the most powerful work that gets out there, because you're not worried. You're just really being true to yourself and what you need to write about.
I always remember the story of Proust, who no one published Swan's Way because they said the sentences were too long.
Yeah.
So then he started on the second installment, And he started the second installment with one of the longest sentences in the entire work, which I thought was so brave and so such a good lesson. You know, he didn't care. He'd been rejected by 20 houses because the sentences were too long, so he started his next book with the longest sentence yet. So that I thought was always inspiring.
We are drawing down on the hour. I wonder if both of you could offer any sort of last words of advice to the writers listening who are working on novels and trying to power through.
Ron, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it's so interesting with what you do, Darren, the teaching at NYU, and it is a hard time. I notice this with my three children. It's a hard time to be a young person. It's really hard because you want that instant gratification in ways that my generation, you know, even as kids, never even dreamed of. It's like, I'll give this the one shot, and I won't give it again. I won't give it I won't even give it a thought. I'll try something else. And if there are any young writers that I could give any advice to that would even have their antenna up and listen, it's that it's a vocation and an avocation, and it's got to really come from the heart. And I always say about the material moving through you, but the guys, just for example, that I read, and I mentioned Wallace Stegner, the people in his great writing class in Stanford, they were so committed to a life of it, and they knew they would have to teach, they would have to work regular jobs, but they were committed to it and not to instant success. And I think that if kids out there that have real talent to write and that aren't needy enough to need to have a bestseller for that first book, I think they can have a lovely career that could last all their lives.
Mm.
Even if their publications are in smaller publications.
Yeah.
I think that's great advice. I was going to say something similar, so mine will just be, I guess, more technical, but I was just thinking, also, there's this stench of plagiarism around, so people are afraid to steal, but, you know, that's how you learn. So I would say to young writers, read as much as you can, which seems also self-evident, but so many writers, young writers, don't read that much. And so figure out what you like and what you don't like. And reading what you don't like can also be very instructive because you'll say, well, how would I do that better? And so, but then when you read something you like, figure out, how can I steal from this? What can I learn from it? You know, I'm not talking about literally stealing or plagiarizing, but, you know, don't be afraid to be influenced at first. What do I like about Hemingway? Well, the short, clean sentences. Okay, I'll try that, see if that's my style. Or maybe Nabokov, I like how flowery he is. Maybe I'll try something really lyrical. And then, you know, and mixing it all, if you steal from enough sources, you'll eventually cobble together something that's your own.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Come to
great
your own advice. Voice. Sure. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for being on. I think, are both of you out here soon on your book tour?
I'm in Denver right now, and I'm flying to L.A. This afternoon.
And you're going to be at Vroman's tonight?
Yeah.
Vroman's in Pasadena, Ron McLarity. And what about you, Darren?
Well, actually, I was at Vroman's about a month ago. My tour is winding down. I'm in, I think, Portland, Maine. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, we have listeners.
I don't think I'll be back out to L.A. for a while.
Well, we have listeners all over, and this show will be podcast, so you'll have lots of people listening and reading your books. And thank you again so very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Ron McLarity, author of Art in America, published by Viking, and Darren Strauss, author of More Than It Hurts You, published by Dutton. And you can both find them online, Google their names. They have websites. They have all sorts of things written about them, wonderful reviews, and give their books a look-see, because reading good stuff like theirs is informative. It teaches you how to write well and what good writing is, and as well as being good reads and entertaining. And if you're interested in Munchausen syndrome, More Than It Hurts You is really kind of fascinating. I'd never been so familiar. I've never been so familiar with what it is until I read this book. Anyway, we're going to go now. If you want to know more about the show, go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on the weekly email list. I will update my schedule so that you will soon see who is going to be on the show throughout this month and next. And we have some good guests coming up, as always, and good podcasts, which you can reach by going to my website again, penonfire.com, click on the radio tower, and you'll see instructions for reaching the podcast page. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I will see you next time.